Thank you, everybody. My name's Danny Heath, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey.
Shit, you're not. I know they added that line in there about in poor taste because some of these guys may have known a little bit about me. I jest about that, and I hope I keep it in good taste. But my sobriety date is 3/4/05, and this is not my first dance. I'm a retread, however you want to call it. I've been in the program before. Just a little closer here.
I'll just get it up higher for
you. Okay. Thank you. If anything tonight, I want to instill some hope in you guys that you can recover, no matter what. And realize that if you're coming to believe that God can restore your sanity, coming to believe in a power greater than yourself, and having the willingness to turn your life over to God, to strive to be more God-like, to try to serve other people, is really the key to being happy. I keep learning that lesson over and over in the short time I've been sober. We'll back up a little bit, and I'll run through this real quick. The last time I told my story, I was so nervous about it. I didn't think about it tonight at all. I made it a point not to try to come up with a prepared speech or any plan of action. The last time I did that, I told the drunk a lot. I was born and raised in Kansas City, and I had a pretty normal childhood. I thought that there was one thing that I realized early on I wasn't like other kids. I was, from early on, I was told I was a loner. I remembered having fear as a child a lot. My dad traveled an awful lot. I remember experimenting with alcohol and drugs for the first time in the fifth grade. Dropping acid and doing mescaline and many whites and some other things. And we did that one summer. And at that time, I was into being an athlete, so I really devoted myself to being an athlete and working out and trying to be the best jock I could be. I had aspirations of setting world records in track. And I stayed away from drugs and alcohol until I turned 15. And I remember after I won the tri-state meet for the AA Junior Olympics, I was real disappointed because it qualified me to go to the Nationals in L.A. And I was all excited because if you took first or second place at the Nationals, you automatically made the Olympic track team. And I had all these dreams and aspirations, and I was told that I couldn't go because I was underage. I'd be 16 years of age. And I went back, and I had a few weeks before we started school, and it became real apparent to me I was lonely. All of my friends were smoking pot, the peer pressure and whatnot, and finally I gave in and started smoking pot with them, and I did that very alcoholically. I continued on through school first and second year as a jock, and then became a hippie, if you want to call it. And went to private parochial schools all my life. I was an altar boy, and I remember being asked not to come back to Bishop O'Hara after my third year because they wrote a very polite letter stating that Danny, even though he is a leader, he has a tendency to lead all of our student body the wrong way. And I had turned on the entire high school to drugs. So I graduated from Hickman Mills. It was the first graduating class, and I remember being way up in the stands, and we all had photos and drinking that day. And that's what really kicked off my drinking after I got out of high school. I didn't want to go to college, and I'd always wanted to go into business for myself. And drifted around and did odd jobs and whatnot, and during that time I backed up. I got in trouble with the law for the first time There was a couple of times during high school I was arrested for selling drugs. The second time was to an undercover agent, and my dad had to pay quite a bit of money to keep me out of prison, out of the juvie home out of Boonesville. And it was actually the third time. One other time I got in trouble for beating somebody up. But I don't want to dwell too much on this, but I tried college. It didn't work out too well. It's the guy that always showed up with the picnic basket and a bottle of wine and the cold fried chicken, and we'd skip class and go out to my buddy's farm and go skinny dipping and horseback riding. I started my own landscape business there and was also working for the operating engineers. My grandfather said, if you're not going to go to college, you need to get some sort of a trade. So I tested 4 or 5 out of 700 some odd guys and was accepted, 140 men accepted into their apprenticeship program. And I went through that for 3 years. And during that time, I was making really good money, but I wanted to supplement my income. And I kept dealing drugs. And I decided one day when my friends were complaining about not having the new trucks like all the other guys every year that the best thing to do was to steal their trucks so that they could get the insurance on them, and they'd get a new truck every year. And I started my little career as a car thief. That really brought me to Atlanta in 1980. I came down there running from the DEA, the local vice, and the FBI. And I hid out for 2 years. I was afraid to go to work, obviously. I didn't want to have any record of being employed where they could find me. My dad helped me start my own business. And my dad fast became my best friend. And I had a pretty bad drug habit, an alcohol problem. When I came down here, it was pretty hard. I remember I had thrown myself in front of a cab, and I had $1,500 on me at the time. 15 policemen that came through the door, and I went out the back door, and I threw myself in front of a cab and gave this cab driver all my money. Said my dad was dying, had to make it to the airport, and I had called my dad prior to that after I ran out of the house, and he said there's a plane ticket waiting for you. He had been tipped off, and I got on the plane and I was shaking, not just out of fear, but also because I had realized that I had woke up, and I remembered I had shakes every morning when I woke up, and I had to drink to calm myself, and all the flight attendants thought I was just so overcome with the thought of my dad dying that I needed to make, I didn't have any money, they fixed me up with 3 stiff drinks. When I got down there, and that's when I had to tell my dad what was going on, and then my mother helped to wean me off of it, to sort of more or less detox me. I was working a couple years later, and I started my own company, and, I justified drinking because of the stress. I justified drinking because of success, because I was doing so well. I had built up this landscape service from just me and a truck, and Sears mower and a rake and a broom. Where in a few years, I had 25 guys working for me. And every morning, before I go to bed, I had to make sure I had a couple of beers in the fridge, because when I would get up, I would be shaking so bad I had to put them in the sink and try to keep from chipping my teeth as I drank them. And then usually I would throw up after the first one. Yeah, I always had to have the second one to call myself so I could go get some more beer. And at that time, I was drinking about a case a day. And it was a week before Mother's Day, 1 year, 1984. After 3 day binge and in a blackout, I almost killed my dad, beating him to death, and I slapped my mother. And there was a guy that saved my life. And became my best friend. And I almost killed him. When I came out of the blackout, the police were there, and my 3 brothers had pulled me off, and my dad, my mother had broke a vase and a there were some other things over my head trying to get me off of it. And I didn't realize that I had did it, that you know, he's laying there in his pool of blood, and that I had did it. And that's when I realized I had a drinking problem, and I had to admit it. I mean, it was concrete evidence. I spent a little peach for, and I'll never forget, you know. You know, I was in denial, you know, so to speak. I told my little brothers, went back to the car on the road. I said, come over and pick me up at midnight. I'm going to break out of here. I'm just going in here to please Mom and Dad, get everybody off my back. After I got in, I realized I had a problem, and I came out, and I went into a halfway house, and I stayed there a couple of weeks because of an incident that had happened at the halfway house. The young man had been raped, and they wouldn't kick the other guy out, and I couldn't live at that time. I felt that I was condoning that by staying there. And I said, I'm leaving. And I went out and I got a house. I sent the mortgage on a house. And I remember shortly after that, I had several guys that moved in with me. It was like a little clubhouse to itself. There was a bunch of us. And I said I was in the program. It was another fellowship. It's NA. That's okay to say that tonight. It was on the stand there. It was great. And I'll never forget. Never spent any time with my brother and my ex-partner at the time. After I got out of the hospital, you know, after work, like I used to drink with them. And they said one night, they said, you can have a beer with us. You know, why don't you stick there and chat with us? You got a drug problem. You don't have a drinking problem. You can have just one beer. And I said, yeah, you know, you're right. I got a drug problem. I don't have a drinking problem. And I'll never forget the realization that they had warned me, you know, that you'll eventually go back to your drug of choice. And I had that one beer, and while I was having that beer, his brother was in the other room on the phone trying to get up to Baker Street to an 8-ball. And I was trying to figure out how I could sneak out of there and get up there with Buddy's little brother, Billy, and cop an 8-ball. And when they offered me a second beer, that's when I realized how my mind was racing, how I was right back off to the races. And I ran up out of there. I said, man, no, I can't have that beer. I can't have one beer. You know, I got to go. And I remember running back to the house and diving in bed at about 7:30 at night, hoping that nobody would see me. And I got up the next morning, and I came over here in Navajo to the 7:30 meeting, and I picked up a white shirt. I proceeded to go on for several years after that. I managed to stay, I wouldn't say sober, I stayed dry for about 5.5 years, almost 6 years, up to 1990. And I say that because I really never worked the program. Gee, can I get some drink? Some water or something. You know, I have sponsors, Vegas sponsor, I still love Bill to this day. He's a great sponsor. He took me through the ninth step and tried to take me through the rest of the steps. And it was like, when I got mine, I felt like, you know, I got mine, now y'all get yours, you know. I'm in good shape. I'm back in good with the family, and thank you. And, you know, things are going great. I don't need to let the rest of this program, you know, and you know, I'm making a lot of money. And my priorities screwed up. You know, it was all self-will, self-knowledge, you know, that was going to keep me sober. And, you know, my sponsor today has told me, sick people attract sick people. And I'll never forget that line. I say that because it was about after 5 years and my sponsor couldn't get me to work another fifth step. I wasn't sponsoring any other people. He said I needed to sponsor other people. And I proceeded to start to feel different from everybody in the rooms. Started getting tired of hearing everybody whine. There was probably a solution being shared in the meetings, but I wasn't listening to it. I was there just for the party. I was a bit of a cockhound, and you know, it was all about the girls, good times, and making money. And I went back out. I ran into another girl who felt different from everybody else. And we both felt like we wanted more than just the program. And I remember praying to God for an entire year before I went back out for God to put a woman in my life that I could have as a partner, that I could get married. And I warned you to be careful what you pray for. I got it, and the marriage didn't last long. It was a shotgun wedding. And the night we got married, we both went back out. We proceeded to become weekend warriors, me more so than her. And it was shortly thereafter, a couple of years of being married and still running my business, that my dad started to die. And I didn't realize until I started going through it just how much I depended on it. And I went through a period of having to take care of him for about 6 months. Every other night was my night, stay up all night with my dad. And that's when I got back on drugs real bad because I couldn't run the business and get without all the sleep. So after my dad died, my ex-wife, 1 week to the day after I buried him, said, "Get out of the house. When I get home, I want you gone." And she proceeded to kidnap my son, and it took me $5,000 in a month and a half to find him with the detective's help. And I said I was going to go back into the program. I tried going to a few meetings, and it just didn't work. And I couldn't work. I was on this huge pity pot feeling sorry for myself. And one day I closed the gates. And I walked away. I told the man, I said, "That's it. We're not working anymore." And I didn't have any place to live. I was living over at the office. And that lasted for about a year. I went through about $480,000. And I just stayed drunk every day, feeling sorry for myself. And I proceeded to go back out for about 15 years. I became homeless. I lived on the streets for about 3 years. And I'll never forget when I got on the streets. I'd been out there for about, a couple of months. I ran into a guy named Bro. I ain't going to tell you his real name, but his first name was William. But we became close. And I lived over at Bankhead in Hollywood. And don't let the name Hollywood throw you. There's nothing Hollywood about it. I was known as Crime Time. That was my nickname on the street. It was Crime Time. I get drunk and I start to cry. I was on this huge pity pot, and one day he said, "What is your story? Why are you here? Blah blah blah." So he shut down his shop, and for a day and a half we got loaded, and I just poured out this long drawn out story to him. And at the end, he took a deep sigh and he says, "You can't see the forest for the trees. You've got people who love you. You've got talent. You've got a lot of things going for you. God loves you. I love you. Your family loves you. But yet, that's not what you want." He said, "Don't ask me how I know or why I know, but God is going to give you 3 signs. And I don't know when it's going to happen, but it's going to happen." And I'm going to go through this real quick because I don't want to tell a war story again tonight. But real quick, it was about 6 months later, I'm over at the office and I'm doing something other than drinking. And I just got me a really big one, and the phone rings. And at the time when the phone rang, I was in the pitch black room in the middle of the living room. And if you've ever seen dry ice flow over the edge of a chest, you know what that looks like. It looks like fog rolling down a wall. And I'd heard this humming noise, and all of a sudden it was like somebody turned on a dimmer switch, and the light bulbs just started to barely glow, and as it got louder and louder, the lights get just a tiny bit brighter. But as it did, the fog was coming out faster and faster. It was rolling down the walls, and I got this tremendous paranoid feeling of fear that I was doomed, that I was going to somehow die in this room. And As I was going on, the phone rang, and it was Bro. And he said, Darren, I said, man, Bro, you're not going to believe what's going on. He goes, oh, yeah, I will, and I do believe. And he says, remember I told you you're going to see three signs? You're about to see the first one. And it was at that time, it just was real quiet, and I heard this. And it was like a clock, 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 clock in the distance coming towards the wall. And it got louder and louder, and as the fog got lower and lower to the bottom, I felt as if the fog got to the floor, it was going to close me in, and I was not going to be able to get out, and I was going to die. And as it was about a foot off of the floor, the clock got louder and louder till it stopped, and all of a sudden I seen a hoof come through the wall. And I knew it was the devil coming to get me. And I screamed out and cried out to God, God, please help me. And I curled up in the fetal position, and it was like, just everything went quiet. And I don't know how long I laid there, but when I opened my eyes, I heard Bro, the phone was on the floor, and he's screaming, Danny, Danny, can you hear me? And I looked around, and it was totally black. The fog was gone. It was quiet. There was no dimmers, no lights or anything. And I picked up the phone. I said, you're not going to believe what just happened. He goes, oh, yeah, I do believe. You just seen your first sign. And he hung up. And I say that because you would think that that would stop me right there. I mean, that is as real as this podium right here to me. Believe me, it happened. It didn't stop me. I continued on. I had to get about as low as you could get. I was homeless for almost 3 years. I was on the streets. And I almost died out on the streets. Was hit with a cinder block over an argument over some money out of the dealer. I was rushed to grave. I fell outside the road bleeding to death. And I was in intensive care for 3 days. I came out of there. My mother, my brother would fill the bed. And when I came to consciousness, the first thing I heard was, he looks like a skeleton. And I weighed about 160 pounds. And my mother helped to, I don't know what term to convalesce or help me recover. I was a month later, as soon as I could walk, it cut me from here to here, gutted me like a fish, and to take my spleen out. And it's a month later when I could walk to the end of the drive, I was off to the races again. But in my mind, I was going to go back to work. I didn't want to go back to the streets, so I went back to work, and I got a couple of jobs. I got the job where I'm at now. I've been there for 15 years. And, I went to one apartment and was evicted from there because I didn't pay the rent after so many times, lost all my clothes and whatnot. Went into another apartment and was getting DUIs. And, nothing really changed. I finally, after about my third DUI, I had two DUIs, and I was not going to get my third one, and I said, I'm not going to do time in jail. So I think I'll move into this hotel right across the street from the office. I'll move in there temporarily, get my license back, get a car again, and I'll get my shit together. All these great intentions. To make a long story short, I got stuck on sleeper for 7 years. It was 7 years later, I woke up one morning after trying night after night after night to not drink all night and to not do crack cocaine all night, and to not get no sleep. And I passed out one morning, the alarm went off, and I overslept, slept through the alarm. It was about 9:30, 10 o'clock, and I realized I was late for work. And I got to the bed, and next thing I knew, I was crying. I cried out to God, God, please help me. And it was like a light bulb went off. And to me, that was the second sign from God. He said, you need help, call your friend Mark Bird, and get your ass over the turnaround. Called Mark up. He came over an hour and a half later and took me out of the hotel. I came out of that hotel with a half a bag of clothes. That's all I had to my name. I made good money. I was broke every day. Didn't have any clothes. Was buying used tennis shoes, used loafers, T-shirts, and jeans. And it's one of the reasons why today I like to dress halfway decently, because I remember not caring how I looked. I care how I look today. But more importantly, I care how I am on the inside. You know, for so long I was self-seeking, self-centered, frightened. I was full of fear, dishonest. Who was I dishonest to? Everybody, and most of all myself. I lied to myself for so long. I kept saying that, you know, I know I got a drinking problem. I don't give an F, you know? And that's fine. But I was in denial about the unmanageability. My life was unmanageable, and I said, nah, it ain't unmanageable, man. I'm paying the rent. I'm making big money. You know, I'm loaning the prostitutes and the dope dealers and all this other stuff. This is the life. It sucked. It sucked. After 7 years, I couldn't stand it anymore. I was so shallow. I was so selfish. Nobody wanted nothing to do with me. Nothing. I mean, even the people on the streets, I was trying to invite them up to the room so I had somebody to talk to. I went up the road into the halfway house, and that was March 4th, 2005. And I've been alone for so long. You know, I didn't know how to get along with other people. I needed to be told when to go to bed, when to get up. You had to go to work every day to do what you say you're going to do. You know, I was going back and forth on the bus. I didn't have no license. I hadn't had a license for 8 years. I didn't care because I always took cabs. That's great. Cab drivers loved me. They were making a living off of me. I got in over there, and every day I get off the bus, stop the hill, and I have this desire, this urge to drink. And as soon as I'd see the guys coming out of the store, I've told the story sometimes in meetings, but I get off the bus, I see everybody coming out with their six packs, and the first thing it did was remind me what I did every day when I got off work. I went to the liquor store, and I was off to the race. As soon as I got that six pack, the first beer down, I wanted to pick up that glass pipe. And as soon as I wanted, after I did the glass pipe, I wanted to do something else. I ain't gonna say what it was, but anyhow, I had this desire every night, and it was eating my lunch. And finally, one night, an 18-year-old kid, I came in and he said, "What's wrong?" And I told him what was going on. He said, "Why don't you just ask God to remove the urge?" And I said, "Yeah, it's too simple, man. That ain't gonna friggin' work." And so I went buying on it, and the next day it was bugging me again. And I tried it, and you know what? By the time I got to the apartment, it worked. The thought was gone. The next day, the same thing happens. You know what? I tried it again. By the time I got halfway to the apartment, just on the other side of the street, the thought was gone. Third day, it happened again. Before I could get across the street, the thought was gone. The fourth day, before I could get off the bus, the thought was gone. And you know what? That continues to work every day. Anytime I get a desire to drink or to do drugs, or I get an impure thought, it's just not with the drinking. I get impure thoughts all the time. I said, "God, please remove this thought from my mind." And it happens. It's gone. So God is there for me today, guys. And I talked about these signs a couple of times. You know, the second time was when I almost died. I asked this lady, I wanted to die. They said, "You got 30 seconds." So there was like 3 minutes to live. You need sign to sign to gain consciousness when I was dying out on the streets. That was the second sign. And I said, "Nah, being a priest, I want my last rites. I want to say I'm sorry. You know, I'm ready to go. I've made a mess of things, and I feel bad." And this nurse guy, there was like 9 people over me. This, you know, everything. They cut my clothes off, and they waited to put this gas mask over my head. They shaved me down, and they said, "You don't understand. I could save your life." This nurse squeezed my hand, got in my face, and she says, "You can start over. You can start over." She said, "God will forgive you." And that's all I needed. That was a sign from God for me. And you know what? I said, "Okay," and I signed it. And the third sign was when God more or less turned on the light bulb and said, "Call Mark and get up there to the halfway house." And I did. God is continually giving me signs that He's in my life today. You know, the 18-year-old kid saying, you know, why don't you just ask God to remove the thought. It's helped me to really come to believe that God truly can restore my sanity. I got a great sponsor. I made a decision. I went to a couple of NA meetings. I was at halfway out, but I said, this didn't work the first time. I'm going to go to where they started. I'm going to go to AA. I want some books up and buy the book guy that's going to, you know, just take me through the program that's going to be hard-nosed and that's going to pound it into me. And I said, I want somebody that's living by the principles of this program. And it was about the fourth, fifth day I was sober. I came in here to the men's meeting and I found my sponsor. And he was talking about how he was practicing the principles in his life. And I said, that's the guy for me. And I'll never forget, I was so nervous. I spilt his coffee all over him trying to shake his hand. One of the biggest lessons, the first lessons, you know, the first thing he told me, he said, I'll sponsor you on one condition when the time comes that you have to sponsor other people. You have to give back what you've been given. And that made sense to me because that was the one thing I never did before. One of many things, but that was one of the most important ones because I'd often heard in the meetings, you know, you got to give it away to keep it. And, you know, that's why I go to AA today is for two reasons, you know, to keep myself sober and to help others stay sober. And I can't stay sober unless I help others stay sober. It's just that simple. You know, he taught me every morning to get up every morning and need a morning meditation that would remind you that you're an alcoholic. And as soon as you remember that, you're going to figure out that you need God's help. And then after that, you can say your prayers. Ask God to remove you from the bondage of self. That's been the problem all your life. Then we got into these character defects, or these defects of character traits, whatever, however you want to term it. Boy, did I hate that. Here I had been laying the blame on somebody else, the ex-wife and everybody else, all these years. And it was me. It was me. I thought, man, I was so pissed off to find out that I had a role to play in everything. And then after, I was the one who caused all this shit. And I said, well, okay. So, you know, I guess I got to admit, you know, I'm wrong here. And then I came to, you know, want to right away, you know, make amends to everybody. Well, shortly before I started my amends, we go down to the Rock one day. My sponsor takes me down there with Glenn and some other guys. And I want to say this because when I came in here, I was so lonely. I was so sick and tired of being by myself. And I'll never forget the feeling just washing over me like a wave when I went into that auditorium that night. And as I went to my seat, everybody was saying, hey, Danny, good to see you. Good to see you, man. I'm glad you're here. And there's like 600 guys, and everybody's just on fire, and they're all so excited to be there. And everybody's so happy to see each other, and everybody was happy to see me. And then I'm sitting in between my sponsor and Glenn, and I started crying because I realized for the first time, I wasn't lonely anymore. People were really glad to see me. They liked me, you know? I hadn't felt that in a long time. I wanted to make all my amends, and I'm going on too long here. I wanted to make all my amends right away, and my sponsor let me make them in certain orders. You know, these are the ones you can't do now. The one I wanted to make the most was to my son and my ex-wife. He said, you're not ready. You still haven't forgiven your ex-wife. It took me a year and a half of praying for her before I was ready to make those amends. And it blew me away how forgiving and how loving they were when I made them. And I bring this up because there's some bridges that you burn that you maybe can't ever get back across. I can't say what the future holds for me, but I just know for me right now, my ex-wife and my son, they don't have anything to do with me. They love me. They accept me. I tried and I pushed it. My sponsors asked me to stop it, you know, here several years ago. That they've made their own life. They don't want you to be a part of it anymore. That hurt for a long time. It took me a long time to forgive myself, but I have. I can't do anything about it, but what I can do is make myself a better person today and to make myself a part of another family. You know, I was so afraid and I was so lonely for so many years. I've come in here and I'm no longer afraid. I'm no longer lonely. I know I just can't do it by myself anymore. I never could. Never worked before. I don't try to today. You know, I sponsored quite a few guys. I'm currently sponsoring 3 or 4 guys. They've got 3 or 4 sponsors. I got a sponsor. He's got a sponsor. That's the way this thing works. And they're like my family. I love these guys. I tell them all the time I love them. And I mean that. I wouldn't stay sober without them. I could not stay sober without them. The whole group is 12-Step Titans. And I'll never forget, you know, going over there and I heard about this meeting and I was trying to find some different meetings and some people had said, man, this is a really good meeting. It's different. It's a men's meeting and these guys all wear ties. They're real serious about this Friday. They bring it right out of the book. And I was like, you know, that's what I need. I need something right out of the book. And I get over there and there's this one black guy I've never seen before and I forget how to put it, but Ricky's saying all these funny things. There's this blind guy sitting there weaving back and forth and some other guy named Crocodile Dave. And I thought, boy, this is too weird. I get in there and they're bringing it right out of the book. And I said, you know what? After the first minute, I said, man, this is the place for me. This is the place for me. These guys were real. They were bringing it from the heart. And I've been going ever since. I'll back up and tell you, you know, I got my first year. I only got a few minutes here. I got my first year, and I thought I was doing great. And I found out about, you know, having to take my own inventory instead of everybody else's. And the way I found out about that, one day a guy was getting out of my skin, and had been for about a year. Well, actually, a couple of years. And he was going on and on one day as to how all the United States problems were caused by these Mexicans being Catholic and on and on. It started out that way, and it just went on and on and on. And I thought, what is this all about? And I was talking to him, and he interrupted us, and when he interrupted me or whatever, I took offense to that, and he said something smart, and I said, how's it like if I did it? And he said, blah, 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 blah. Next thing I know, I'm over in his face. And, you know, next thing I know, he jumped up, popped me in the mouth a couple of times, and I hit him back, and, it was a couple years later. Cost me $7,000 before I finally got out of trouble on that. But I never forget, you know, I took off less down, I lost the job over it, and I had to really stop and think, you know, what caused all this? And it was taking his inventory. It was being full of fear, taking things personal, just being selfish and self-centered, thinking everything was about me, and it had nothing to do with me. And that started the whole thing. It was all a result of me taking things wrong. And, you know, that's when I realized that I had to work on my character defects. And I had to work on myself, and I had to take daily inventory, you know. And I had to become fed up with my character defects. I had to become sick and tired of my character defects. I had to start really believing that God could remove my character defects. I feel like I've been giving it lip service up to them, so I started really trying. You know, I really started trying to focus on my character defects. I spoke down, you know, I'll never forget one of the latest if you want to call it fourth fist test, that's where actually fourth fist of a doing. My sponsor was here not too long ago. I did one on fear of women and on fear of my mother dying. And it helped tremendously. It was a couple months later, I was able to finally, for the first time in almost 20 years, date a girl. I mean, I've lived without dating somebody for 20 years. And it was great, but I really had a blast. But that's no longer going on. I found out I wasn't as far along on the learning curve. and didn't know what I wanted as well as put to me. So I just wasn't moving fast enough. But anyhow, fantastic girl. I had a great time. I love her to death. I have so much respect for her. I hope it happens again real soon, but I know it's going to happen in God's time. And I know I'm running out of time here, and I just want to say this. Sharing this message is what keeps me trying to learn this program. Keeps me working these steps. When I go through these steps with my sponsees and other people, that's what keeps me remembering how to work this program. My memory's short, and you know, I tell... No, I'm not going to say that. Let me just say my memory's short. My sponsors know what I'm... The sponsees know what I'm talking about. But I over and over have to keep relearning things. And in the 4 years I've been here, I've had to learn these steps over and over and over. Because I forget. I get caught up in things. You know, one of the things I strived for so hard when I got in, I was taught to seek spiritual growth, to get a relationship with God before you get a relationship with a woman. You know, to have that spiritual growth instead of wanting that material wealth. Work on that, and everything else would be a byproduct of your relationship with God. Well, you know what? It's true. It's happened. You know, I came in here with a half a bag of clothes 4 years ago. Didn't have a car, didn't have anything. Today I got a car, today I got a house. Today I got a relationship with other people. My family loves me. People in these rooms love me. Today I got a life. I know I got to go, and I'll just say this. You know, I may not be everything that everybody expected me to be, and I may not have lived up to all their expectations. And I'm just glad I'm not the way I used to be. Thanks.